to Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, I have two wonderful books to tell you about today. And I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Brian Nelson, the author of The Great Unmaking. And he is a brilliant author, and I know he's brilliant because he is a former Fulbright scholar. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Patsy. Wonderful to be here.
Well, thank you. Well, I don't know if I should say former. It's like sort of being a former Marine. Once you're a Fulbright scholar, you're always a Fulbright scholar.
That's right. That's right.
And, of course, I know you're brilliant, not just because you managed to achieve one of the highest levels in academia, but wow, I read this book, The Great Unmaking. It is so brilliant that I'm like, I say, oh my goodness, I have so much to learn here.
Well, I'm so glad you liked it.
Oh, I love it. Well, you know, I knew I would love it right from the beginning. So you have a prologue, and in the prologue, I just loved it. You had tulip poplar, a tree in case anybody out there doesn't understand, that's a tree, a tulip poplar. And then you had Ionic columns. And I thought, oh, well, I know I'm in for a treat here. This guy knows how to write. He also knows something, because I have been amazed recently as I've realized more and more people don't quite understand, particularly nature, and particularly trees. And so I was thrilled with tulip poplar because I know what that tree is. And I just discovered an author who was writing a book. I read her manuscript. Thank goodness she has not published it yet. And she has the main character, you know, planting tulips in July in Florida. And I'm no. You know, I mean,
yeah, those things are so important. Those things are so important because they pull you out, right? They pull you out of the story.
Exactly.
You want to be in, you want to go along, you're willing to be carried along by the writer. And if you make those little mistakes, if you make too many of them, then the reader's pulled out and they lose faith in you, right? It's very important.
Oh, absolutely. That's why. Well, of course, you know, but, and I didn't actually, you know, I never read anything about the author, you know, somebody who comes new to me. I don't read anything about them when I start a book. I don't read the back blurb. I don't read anything. I want it all just to come to me. And so I got such a kick out of it. I knew right away. And then, of course, it turns out that trees play an important part in your entire story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, setting, the environment. I wanted to make that a big part of this because I tried to bring in, you know, cultural themes. Like what are the themes that people are worried about? What are the things going on in the world? Each book I try to bring in, you know, some new kind of idea that I know is sort of on the public mind. Yeah.
Well, you certainly achieve it in a big time way. Now, this is the third book in your series, Course of Empire series. And at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk about a nonfiction book that you wrote. And that, of course, well, for me, it's when The Economist, you know, having lived in England for a long time, when The Economist says somebody's book is great, you know, I always say, okay, I have to read that book. So, and that is The Silence of the Scorpion, The Coup Against Chavez, and The Making of Modern Venezuela. So we'll get to that after, at the bottom of the hour. But
okay.
Let's step
Excellent.
Back for a minute. The Great Unmaking. In a way, it's a horror story.
Yes, it is. It's the whole series, right? So I worked in computer development, and of course, whenever you write a book or any book, your most important priority is to entertain. So there is a lot of action. It is an apocalypse story. In many ways, the world comes to an end. But I'm obviously, you know, trying to sort of deal with these kind of interesting ideas about technology, humanity's connection to technology, how sometimes things that we think are going to be great and are going to be revolutionary and change the world don't end up quite like we expect them to.
Not at all. one of the lines that you write, something about drawing a line in the sand. And that's so appropriate for so much that's happening in this world when we haven't drawn lines and when we let those lines just disappear. So how do you want to explain to people what this story is about? Because recently, you know, there's so much news about nanoparticles being in our water bottles. So suddenly people who never heard of nanoparticles are like, oh, right, what are those things? And when they say, you know, there's a 500,000 in every water bottle. So now that's great for your book, actually, because now people say, well, he really is onto something here.
Right. Yeah, so the whole series is based on this sort of integration of three kind of emerging technologies. So it deals with artificial intelligence, it deals with genetic engineering, it also deals with nanotechnology, right? And in a lot of fiction, nanotechnology is kind of like magic, right? It's just sort of, oh, some tiny nanobots go in and they fix, you know, whatever problem is going on for the Enterprise or whatever, you know, TV show or book you're watching. But I really wanted to explain or go a little bit deeper into that science in this series because I think it is very fascinating. So essentially, nanotechnology is when you're dealing with things on an almost atomic level. So you're creating tiny little machines that can manipulate things at the scale of an atom. And while this sounds very science fiction-y, we knew even back in the 50s, Richard Feynman, the Nobel-winning physicist, noted that this will happen because it happens in us now, which is very fascinating. So every time that you blink, every time that you digest food, every time some mineral is taken across your cell wall, that is nanotechnology at work in your body. It's these microscopic machines that are doing very fast, efficient work for you. So this idea in the book is that the military wants to revolutionize this technology for weapons. And that can be to good in the sense that you could cure diseases, but it could also be used to make some pretty frightening types of weapons, including the ability to sort of enter someone's body and not simply kill them, which is one of the things you could do, but also manipulate them. And you could make someone frightened. You could make someone, their adrenaline spike and make them homicidal. You can literally get into someone and begin to manipulate their bodies with this kind of technology. So in this third book, it's when the AI sort of begins to get much more advanced, which is kind of appropriate for what's happening now in the world. But I'll say that I didn't want my book to be where AI is the bad guy, in the sense that it's not, you know, Neo of the Matrix against Agent Smith, or, you know, Mark Bowman against the HAL 9000 in 2001. I didn't want the AI to be born and be naturally evil and want to kill all humans, right? I felt that was becoming too cliche. So all of the AI in the book is basically doing exactly what it's designed to do. And it's much more about the people who are making these different artificial intelligence systems that sort of precipitate this global collapse.
It all comes down to people.
Yeah.
There's good and there's bad. And in your book, we have some really bad people.
Yes. And I think, you know, people are afraid of AI. People are afraid of new technology. I am too, but I'm actually a little bit more afraid of scientists than I am of the technology they create, because I think there's some really dangerous mentalities out there when it comes to developing new technology. And there's much more of a sense that I'm doing this because if I don't, somebody else will. So that's brought to the fore in the first book, which is really kind of an arms race between the U.S. government and China, the U.S. military and the Chinese military, to sort of revolutionize this new technology. So both sides are thinking, I have to do this before the other side does it.
Yeah, it's sort of like coming up with yeah, I think we've gone through that in the past few years, whatever the pandemic brought us, that it is, it is people who get these ideas and then decide to run with them and don't think of the consequences.
Absolutely.
But in the end, you know, a book is about plot, which you have a wonderful plot, but you also have to really get people involved with the characters. And I was, when the book started, of course, you know, my interest in Africa and my love of animals, and I get like really crazy when people are hunting elephants. So when it started off, explain your main character, because I think that, you know, we have to understand the person to then get our, you know, our hopes and dreams into something good happening.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, this is almost a book where it's, I have to think for a moment, who is my main protagonist? Because there's quite a few that almost, you know, are center stage. But Eric Hill is a young scientist. He's just come out of graduate school in the first book. He's hired to come in and try to help with this revolutionary new technology. So he helps create this technology, but then he begins to doubt, you know, why he did it, what it's being used for, will it be used for good or bad? And of course, he's someone who we'd call an early adopter. He's someone who believes in technology and believes that it's the answer. But in the second book, he's on a mission to Africa, and he's incapacitated, he's injured, and he falls in with a Khoisan tribe in Namibia. So this was a very fun juxtaposition for me, because I've got someone who's at the cutting edge of technology living in America, who's suddenly living without technology. And for me, what's super fascinating is to think about how we as human beings were designed to live versus how we force ourselves to live in modern society. So, you know, are we designed to live, to stare at a computer screen for 12, 13 hours a day? Are we designed to be in traffic for 2 hours a day? Are we designed to sit around and be sedentary all day? You know, no. And there's a big difference between how we evolved to live and the way we're sort of forced ourselves to live. So to put the character in a space, to put Eric in a space where he's like, oh, this is what a world without technology looks like, was sort of important in his evolution as someone who begins to doubt, you know, how important technology is and if we really need it that much.
And and of course, as you said, it's, although he comes, you know, as the main character to me, you have a lot of wonderful characters in there and many strong women. I love the strong women in your book, including, well, actually, one of the terrorists.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. That was a fun character to create because, you know, you always want to make them three-dimensional. I want you to understand why people think the different ways that they do. And I think that's representative of how, or something we've kind of lost, right, in America. We're not thinking about why, okay, I don't agree with this person, but what's making them believe what they believe that's different from me? So my goal was to hopefully make people understand those different points of view from different characters who are each have their own backstory, each have their own sort of, you know, seminal events that have created their motivations for doing what they do.
For you, of course, being a Fulbright scholar, words come to you easily. Writing must come to you easily. So you have this background in, you know, that you've learned so much. But in the end, it also comes back to the fact that as a child, you must have been a pretty good reader.
There's actually a pretty interesting story there. I was not a very good reader. I had a bit of a problem. My mother taught me to read at home. And then when I got to first grade, I was apparently cheating. I had a student teacher that year, and, I wasn't following the rules that she had for reading. So I basically stopped reading for about 3 years. until like fourth grade, fifth grade, I started to read again. So I have good comprehension, but I'm still a very slow reader. And yeah, it's just something that I enjoy doing now, but I got a late start in the game compared to most people.
Oh, that's funny, because mm-hmm. when I was in third grade, now I was a big reader from the time I was two. When I got to third grade, they're doing these Dick and Jane books. And I had already been reading my mother's Perry Mason paperback books.
Right.
First thing, like within a day, when I refused to stand up, you know how they went around the room and you'd stand up and you were supposed to read a sentence, a paragraph. And I refused to do that. I mean, that was too stupid to me. And so she called me stupid. She, the teacher in front of everybody, said I was stupid. And so after that, I was like, I'm not reading anything in this room, because I was sneaking in paperback books. And it was my father who came to the school, and my father was a very impressive guy, and he walked up to her. He was so sweet, and he said, Patsy can read. And after that, I could take any book, and I could sit there all during the class, all during the day, because, you know, you had one teacher for the day, and yeah. read whatever I wanted.
Oh, good. Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah,
that's a great story. But yeah, it's sort of the danger of being typecast, or the danger of sort of internalizing something. A message that you get from a teacher at a young age can be pretty powerful, right? Mm.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, well, somewhere along the line, you did learn how to comprehend and read to get to the point where you are. Because I also noticed I always like to, you know, examine people's writing. And with you, I was okay. I have no problem. And I just like the way that you write. You know, you have things like pinged and clanged and hissing and creaking, sort of shades of Charlotte Bronte there. I got a kick out of that.
Good, the onomatopoeias. Yeah, that's great.
I caught them. I thought, this is some great writer. But as I said, you have the wonderful characters. Let's talk a little bit about this African tribe, because this is very important, and about this concept of what's behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's funny, because when I was starting the second book, which I thought, I'm going to have this secret mission in Africa, and the character Eric will be there maybe a couple chapters, and then I'll bring him back. And then I began to do my research on the Khoisan tribes, and I just fell in love with it. And I was like, this is the book. This is exactly what this book needs. So it ended up being almost the entire novel. The second book was placed in Africa, and then this book, about 40-50% is in Africa. And it just felt right in a lot of ways, again, because I've mentioned the idea of juxtaposing technology versus not having technology. And it was just kind of a personal love story that I wanted to share the sort of hardships that this group has had, right? As they're sort of marginalized, pushed aside, mining companies, you know, first world interest pushing, always sort of making them move from one place to the other, sort of destroying their way of life. And I was like, it just felt so, you know, you have to be careful with the whole sort of noble savage idea. But to me, it was felt very fresh, felt very sincere, and everything just sort of seemed to click. I was able to have it be engaging and entertaining. But I also felt I was getting across a lot of heartfelt feelings and personal connections that the characters were creating amongst themselves, like Eric's relationship to the tribe and the members of the tribe, especially a young boy that he befriends. And that just sort of naturally all came together.
Well, it certainly does. And let's talk a little bit about the series and where you got the title and why you're calling it the Course of Empire.
That was something that had been in the back of my mind. You know, I'd had this job working in IT for General Motors. I was thinking a lot about technology and how technology was changing. And I found this series of famous paintings by Thomas Cole, who's an American painter. He's part of the Hudson River School. And it's fantastic, actually. It's five big paintings that he did together, and they sort of show the evolution of a civilization. So the first picture is sort of primitive man living, you know, hunter-gathering. The next image is like, you know, creating some basic technology like boats and sails. And then it just sort of goes through this sort of evolution. And then the penultimate image is of like a civil war of civilization. It looks very Greco-Roman. There's a war going on. You're seeing, you know, pillage of a city. And then the last image is simply, it's called Desolation, and it's just the same landscape as the original painting, but you just see ruins and vines and things like that. And that was an early inspiration for the series, because I was like, huh, these paintings were done, you know, 130 years ago. But I was like, well, how would that look today? How would our civilization sort of rise and fall, and what would cause that? And of course, my immediate answer was our own advanced technology would probably be our undoing. And that was the inspiration for the series.
Well, and of course, that series is, if anybody's in New York, that it's worth definitely going to see that, because it's impressive. And the first book, now I will tell you, once people read this third book, I think they will want to go back to the beginning of the series, because right away, as soon as I finished that one, I went and started on The Last Sword Maker. Okay. Because, you know, and there, of course, as you mentioned, there it is involving China and you know, getting captured and all of that. And I thought that book is great, too.
Yeah, yeah. And similarly, right, with the Khoi San tribe being a centerpiece in the second and third books, the idea of Tibet and what was going on in Tibet and the relationship to China, that became the sort of thing that I learned the most about in writing that book, and sort of helped create some really powerful characters and scenes that I also wanted to sort of felt like I was sharing, and sort of sharing that knowledge that I'd learned through the book.
Well, it's a great series, and yeah. I want to talk more about your other writing. And I have to take some commercials, but please hold on. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, this is another sort of subject, right, everybody's thinking about at this moment, Venezuela, which, who knows, I don't know if you're going to go back there and write the next book about them, if there's a war. So we'll be right back. Just hold on, okay, Brian?
Sure, no problem.
Okay. This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Brian Nelson, and we are going to be talking about his nonfiction book in a minute, but I wanted to just go back for a minute to his latest book, book three in his series, and it is called The Great Unmaking. When you read a book, sometimes things will sort of stick with you, and in The Great Unmaking, we'll never forget that scene. There's a lot of scenes in there that I'll never forget, but one of them is where you mentioned, how can I say, dead skin being eaten. I like that scene.
In the Great Unmaking,
yeah,
the skin being eaten.
Well, we're talking about carbon rain, and we're talking about all of the things, and then when he was captured, and so it's just, I thought, you know, there are lots of things in the book that I will remember. One of the things, it's so funny, because there's sort of there's the nature, there's clouds. You describe, particularly you describe trees and the beauty of the forest and things like that, and a lot of forest in a lot of places that people, I can't tell people where there are going to be forests in the future. You turn a lot of the world into a forest. But I, for some reason, I kept thinking about a poem by William Wordsworth. It just struck me, you know, I wandered lonely as a cloud. I wandered, that's one of his poems, and it's so beautiful. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. And so as I'm reading your book, I kept saying, yeah, well, you know, there's going to be a lot of daffodils going around here.
Yeah. So, yeah, I had some fun sort of thinking about this idea of geoengineering, right? So there's this idea that in order to fix the problems with climate change, we'll come up with ever more sort of elaborate ways to change the environment to sort of stabilize carbon levels and things like that. So one of the ideas is that you can create a whole series of vegetation that lives during the winter, because as the world works, as most of the vegetation is in the northern hemisphere, during the winter, the amount of oxygen that goes into the atmosphere is vastly cut. So if you created a whole series of vegetations that could live throughout the winter, then you would keep the oxygen level high throughout the year. So that's one of the ideas that this eco-terrorist has in using this technology, is to sort of geoengineer the world to sort of reverse the effects of climate change.
Yeah.
But as you'll see, of course, something goes terribly wrong.
I could have told them that. That just come to me, because I'll tell you something. If you live in northern Michigan, as I was born in northern Michigan, you want when you have maple trees, you want them to get cold, and you want the sap to freeze, and then you want in the spring for it to unfreeze and start running, and
right.
You want it. So you don't want people to fool around with your maple trees up there.
Right. Yeah.
So,
and again, that's the hubris, right? That's the idea that, okay, we can fix this, right? You know, like,
yeah.
That we've seen so many times, you know, like, you've got a problem with insects in Australia. Let's release these cane toads and see what happens. The cane toads will take care of it, right? You know, we've got too many rabbits in Australia. Let's release these foxes and see what the foxes do. And the foxes don't eat the rabbits. They eat the marsupials.
Right? So. Yeah, so, I mean, this is what we're talking about. So that's why in this book, it's really, it makes one think a little bit about what in the world people get in their heads. Thinking of William Wadsworth, one of the things he so would say to people, get out, just get out and enjoy nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would add today, don't mess with Mother Nature.
But don't mess with it, yeah. Just leave it alone, right?
Okay. So, but, oh, wow, that leads us now. Let's talk a little bit about how you became a scholar and then how you wrote this book about Venezuela and whether or not, if there's a war down there, since you're such an expert, if maybe they'll send you to be a reporter down there.
Well, the Fulbright ended up being a wonderful kind of blessing. It was a wonderful sort of bit for me. I had some skills in finance and economics, and I had a degree in international relations from undergrad, and then I had my writing degree, which I'd just gotten when I got the Fulbright. So I had the perfect mix of kind of skills. Plus, I'd actually lived in Venezuela for a year of high school, so I already knew the culture to some degree. I had friends there. A lot of my friends had split. A lot of them were now pro-Chavez, and another group of them were anti-Chavez. So when I arrived there in 2002, I actually had connections within the government, but also in the opposition to the government. So it was just a very kind of fortuitous event, and challenged me in lots of ways, but also was the perfect challenge for me. And yeah, a really, really great kind of experience. I must admit, I did not do what I was supposed to do. I was given a grant to write a novel, you know, like a multi-generational novel, sort of like a Midnight's Children for Venezuela, you know. And I got there, and the truth of what was happening on the ground was so incredible and almost unbelievable. I was like, I don't need to invent anything. All of what I need is really right here. So I switched from, I was supposed to write a novel, and I ended up doing nonfiction, because I just felt that what was happening was so kind of, I'd arrived at sort of a perfect time to record what was going on.
And it is so relevant to today's world, because right there. Maybe it's now number 5 in the list of important events happening in the world, but you never know, you know, what's going to happen next. So stepping back, of course, one of the wonderful, I mentioned The Economist, you know, selecting it, which must have given you a heck of a thrill.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like, that's a biggie. That's a biggie. People who don't read The Economist might not understand why it is such a big honor to be selected by them, because gee whiz, they are all so smart. So it was great. So what can you say about the rise of Hugo Chavez and John Paul? What can you say about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was. So I went to Venezuela first in 1988, and that was an interesting moment because that was sort of the end of the good days. You have to remember that when the world thinks about its oil crisis of the 70s, you know, that was actually the best time ever for Venezuela, right? Because it's a major oil producer. So at that time, it was flush with oil money. There was tons of, they could get great loans from the IMF and the World Bank. Everybody was living large. Everybody drove these huge, you know, V8 cars. Gas was, you know, amazingly cheap. And then beginning in the late 80s, early 90s, everything sort of started to collapse. Bank failures, price of oil fell. They defaulted on a lot of their bad loans. And so the standard of living in Venezuela, which had been excellent, you know, lavish, people had lived very lavishly, and that was plummeting. And after a decade of that, Chavez comes in. He's a dark horse. You know, he's not a known political entity. He was known just for having tried to overthrow the government, and that made him a little bit of a cult hero, because they're like, oh, here's the guy who stood up to the system. He keeps very quiet about his beliefs during the campaign. He gets elected, and then begins a pretty well-orchestrated move to sort of shift to a socialist or a communist, system. And he's very close to Castro, so he's actually getting a lot of guidance from Castro and how to sort of make this thing operate and to sort of transform society in the sort of revolution that he wants to do. I went being quite pro-Chavez when I went. When I went to start the Fulbright in 2002, I was definitely open to thinking, because I'd seen how bad the country had gone. I saw the downfall in the 90s. I was like, okay, let's give this guy a chance. But I quickly saw that it was not going to work out.
I'm sorry.
Pretty quickly saw it was not going to work out. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of like when people said, oh, give Castro a chance, you know?
Right. Exactly. So, and it was just a few sort of simple things that made me see, one of which was that the rule of law was only going to be applied to pro-Chavez people and not to people against Chavez. For example, land appropriations. I actually knew a guy who had a small dairy farm. He had like 80 cows, right, on this farm, probably 100 acres. And I went to visit him sort of like, just as a journalist, to sort of see what was going on. And he's like, yeah, people are squatting on my land. They're building roads. They're building their houses. And he points to this one man who has a brand new Ford pickup truck. He's like, you see that guy? He owns the funeral parlor in town, but he's making his weekend home on my land. So this idea that if you're against the government anyway, you're going to be penalized. And if you're for the government, you'll get some sort of handout or reward. And that sort of breaking down of the rule of law was kind of indicative. Like the first sort of thing is like, oh, okay, this is problematic. But of course, in my book, as you saw, he was willing and able to use violence against those who opposed him. And that's obviously the thing that really flipped me over, is when I realized that. And that's what's special about that book, is that no one else had kind of proven that. No, there was a lot of video footage, a lot of spin. We saw that people had been killed during this march against Chavez. We saw that there had been a lot of violence and people had died on both sides. So it's very confusing. So what my book did that no one had really done yet was it broke down the whole day and a half of violence into minute by minute, so you could see how everything unfolded. And it was clear that Chavez people had killed the marchers first, And then later in the afternoon, when the police came in, they had killed some of Chavez's supporters. So that's why it appeared that, at first the government tried to spin it the other way. They said, no, you shot at us first. We were just defending ourselves. But why the government attacked me after the book was published is because I was able to show pretty, without really a shadow of a doubt, that it was the government who had started the violence.
It is a fascinating book. It's really great. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is, obviously, I think even at that point, there was this novelist within you because you write so well and you make the story very exciting. I was, although I knew the outcome, and as you said, going in, you were on one side and then sort of moved to the other. And gosh, you know, over the years, I had moved to Europe when I was very young, and I had the opportunity to see East Berlin before it became, So anybody who'd seen that knew that this idea of turning, of whatever the plan was to do to Venezuela was not going to work. But definitely, it's a great book, and I'm so happy that, you know, we have the opportunity to also promote that book today, because I don't know, people are so confused of what's going to happen anywhere in the world.
Right,
but
if they
learn anything, you know, from reading a book, and particularly a book like this, that it opens their eyes, and they say, well, yeah, you know, I hope, you know, we have enough people who can read, who will say, you know, The Silence and the Scorpion, which I love that title, by the way, The Silence and the Scorpion. I thought, well, yeah, read this book. It's well written, easy. It's, how can I say, easy to read, because it is, you have this natural ability to write beautifully. And sort of a warning.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And thank you very much for that. That's very kind. I mean, it's, and my goal was to not be in it. my goal was thinking, you know, there's a divided country here. It's polarized. If a gringo comes down here and writes a book about it, nobody's going to believe anything he says. So the whole idea was to not use my voice at all, but to only use the voices of the people who are actually there during this crisis. So you move from the point of view of a politician to a journalist to a soldier. So I wanted to make it sort of irrefutable that this is really what happened, and not try to put any type of spin on it or minimize spin as much as I could. Yeah.
But you do capture their voices and the people who mm-hmm. who lost so much and who were suffering. I don't know what's happening in Venezuela now, because who knows what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But it's tragic. And, of course, perhaps we can go to New York. We can go down Fifth Avenue and ask all the Venezuelans there what's happening.
Right, right,
you know?
Exactly. Or in Miami, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. In Miami.
No, it is very tragic. It's heartbreaking, really. And the devastation goes across generations. I feel immense kind of, I don't know, a sense of grief or loss in many ways. I had a brother-in-law, so my host family, you know, there that took care of me when I was an exchange student, very close to them. Violence went off the charts because Chavez basically took control of all the police stations because he feared they would rise up against him. So he put his cronies in charge of all the police, which meant that criminals could do whatever they wanted. My brother-in-law was murdered in a carjacking. And then not less dramatically, but also sort of tragically, is just how many people's lives have been destroyed by this. The people that I went to high school with back in 1988 are just as bright. Many are brighter than I am, smarter than I am, should be more successful. But just because of where they were born and the crisis in the country means that they have not been able to live very full lives, because of the way the economy has been destroyed, or the whole country has been destroyed. So it's very tragic, yeah.
It's like, I keep coming back to that line in the sand, when we knew things were happening in Cuba, now, you know, mm-hmm. in those days, and people are still wearing Che Guevara t-shirts, for goodness sakes. I mean, like, they don't know who the heck he was, but they're wearing his t-shirts, which is insane. I mean, it's like, well, what killer do I want to have on my chest today? I mean, it's insane. Sometimes.
Yeah. It's a very bizarre thing that, the people just don't really know the whole, they don't know the whole story. I like to believe if they knew the whole story that they would change their minds. I mean, you know, Che Guevara, when he was in Bolivia, there were two young teenagers that had volunteered to work with him. And then they said, hey, we don't want to work with you anymore. and they said, we want to go back home. And he said, sure. And as they walked away, he shot them. So that they wouldn't, you know,
you know, having, you know, friends in Florida from Miami, people who came, you know, from Cuba, you know, so many years, I've heard their stories and the tragedies of what happened, what they left behind, what they lost. And of course, those people, when they came, they embraced, you know, the American idea and worked hard and have, you know, contributed so much to Miami, to Florida, but it is so difficult still for them to quite comprehend all that they lost, because there is part of them that, you know, the grandparents remember the houses that were just taken away from them.
And it's a shame. I mean, it's a shame because people don't often connect the dots, you know. Cuba now survives largely on tourism, and so people don't realize that when they go to Cuba, they're supporting the government. Like, most of the money is not making it in the hands of the merchants. And of course, the most disturbing thing about that is the sex trade, and that there's a huge sex trade in Cuba, and most of the money from the sex trade does not go to the women who work; it goes to the government.
No, it's okay. I don't know. Sometimes we, perhaps, I don't know, artificial intelligence. We just have to look a little bit more for intelligence among the people. Anyway, you know, it's wonderful to talk to you, Brian. I think you're fascinating. Your books are great. You're absolutely, absolutely a talented writer. And it's been a joy. And my hour's almost up. But again, I just want to mention that you have also a website, and it is called Brian Nelson Books. People, remember to add the word book. So it's Brian Nelson Books. And Brian has a very nice website. You can go and check it out and find out more about him and about his fiction and nonfiction. And what is your Alphonse project? So you have something else going on with you? Like, you don't have enough to do? Alfonso.
Alfonso Mayo. Yes. Yeah, Alfonso Mayo, a wonderful young African-American man who I befriended when I lived in Baltimore, started to write his story out, a very moving, powerful story, short story that's there on the website if you want to check it out. Yeah, it's great. Patsy, it's been wonderful talking to you. Really enjoyed it. Hope we can talk again soon.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it so much. And again, thank you so much for joining me, and have a very happy new year. I'm sure you're working on something new.
I am switching genres again. I'm working on a fantasy novel. So that's been fun. That's been very nerdy for me in the aspect of, like, building languages and playing with word roots and things like that, as I try to create a more elaborate world than I've ever tried to create before. And I'm enjoying the characters that I'm making and the dynamic between them. So playing a lot with sort of the idea of Joseph Campbell's structuralism, you know, classic archetypes, but also trying to make them fresh. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I'm enjoying it.
Okay, well, as soon as you have a release date for that book, you let me know, and you'll be back here on Joy on Paper, okay?
Okay, wonderful. Okay, have a great day. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Everybody, again, it is really great website, as he mentioned. He has a story there about Alfonso Mayo, which I think you will find fascinating. And his website is briannelsonbooks.com. Anyway, wow, that hour went fast. It was so wonderful to talk to him. The name of Brian's book is The Great Unmaking. And it's by Brian Nelson, and you will enjoy it. Bye-bye now.